Mr. Denton, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Denton, would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal, sir?
Yes, Your Honor. 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. Come on up, and whenever you're ready, we're happy to hear from you.
May it please the Court, Jeremiah Denton for the plaintiff, the appellant, Martha Collins. This is a spousal support modification appeal challenging the method by which the trial court arrived at his conclusion on the modest award of spousal support that he gave. And basically, the challenge here is to the fact that the trial court disregarded $145,000 worth of earning capacity, and he also explicitly disregarded $311,000 worth of financial need. Factually, Your Honors, the after a 28-year marriage and an award of spousal support, the former husband, who was a Navy captain, retired at age 49 after 26 years in the Navy. He subsequently worked, starting immediately thereafter, 8 more years. 4 years for a government contractor called Accenture, and immediately following that, when that job dissolved, he didn't quit. The job just went away. But he essentially kept the same substantive job for another 4 years as a Navy civilian employee. Both of those jobs earning approximately $145,000 a year. 2 years later, the wife, a former wife's petition for an increase in spousal support because of an injury that affected her ability to earn a living as a UAL pilot, captain, I believe. The judge ultimately awarded $400 in additional spousal support, but he declined to consider what we maintain is the former husband's post-retirement income and certain of the wife's obligations.
Can I ask you on that, Mr. Denton? The court, in its order, had a number of findings, and then it said there was no evidence of the husband's post-retirement earning capacity upon which to base an imputed income. That is after the actual pension he's getting from his military pension, right? So is that not a finding of fact that we have to give considerable deference to on appeal?
I don't think that's plainly wrong. I think that's a conclusion of law that he reached, and I think that that's one, this the issue that you just raised is one of the three questions that are going to determine the outcome of this appeal, and it's the first one: what income actually is post-retirement income and pre-retirement income? Is post-retirement income, income you earn after the conclusion of a career, or is it income that you earn after the last job you happen to have following your career?
And let me ask you a question about that, sir, if I may. What I understand the evidence to be is that the most recent salary job, if you would, that Mr. Leeds had concluded in 2013.
That's correct.
Okay. So from between 2013 and when this matter was heard in 2017, he was doing volunteer work, but he was not being financially compensated.
That's correct.
And you are asking the court, or your client's asking the court, to impute income to him in 2017 based on that 2013?
That's correct.
But there was no evidence presented other than about the 4 years in between.
And that gets to my second question that I want to address, which is what actually is recent income. but the first question is what is retirement for purposes of post-retirement income, and it's not really been delineated, I don't think, by any case. And I suggest to the court that the delineation should focus on what kind of work you're talking about. Now, if a person has a succession of different jobs and, you know, it's hard to nail down when he's retired, that's one thing. This is a case, though, where you couldn't have a more traditional retirement. 26 years in the Navy as a naval aviator. He retires, he gets a pension that lasts him for the rest of his life. But as many people do, to supplement his income or augment his savings, he takes two jobs essentially in the same field. They are not jobs, though, from which he retires in any traditional sense. They are simply one job dissolved and the other job he quit. And
I'd like to ask you about that, if I may, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but your time goes by so quickly here, as you know. So as of the time of the hearing before the Fairfax Circuit Court, that's on appeal here, 2017, he was 62.
Correct.
And when he stopped working at that last job that was paying approximately $145 or so, he was 58.
I think that's right.
But in the meantime, his security clearance has expired.
That's right? True.
So if it's 4 years ago and the security clearance has expired and he's now at an age that many people just stop working, 62, why, without additional evidence being put on, and given what the trial court found that there was not enough evidence to impute income, how can we reverse if there's really no additional evidence put on to show what he could have made after that if he wanted to?
Well, because I think the evidence of his prior civilian income is adequate. And to answer the security clearance question, there was talk about his security clearance having left at the trial. There was, and probably testimony to that effect. But there was no testimony to the effect that he had to have a security clearance to have the job he had. And there was no testimony that he couldn't simply renew the security clearance just like you can renew a driver's license. So I don't think that in of itself is a bar. Furthermore, we're talking about working in the Navy industrial complex, if you would, Your Honor, of which there are many, many, many jobs that don't require any particular security clearance.
Mr. Denton, if I may, and maybe I'm I think we need, for me, if you don't mind, to back all the way up. You are starting with the presumption, it seems like, that the court has to impute income and has to, because you don't take the person as they are at the time when the case comes forward. And he's been receiving retirement for some period of time. And when he started, he elected to start receiving retirement. It was not in an effort to avoid any type of additional spousal support.
Right.
So my question, I guess, to you, sir, would be, you know, why should he have to pay, you know, the threshold issue, why should he even have to pay, number one, any increased support, which I realize he's paying, what, an additional $400 for some odd dollars, but why would we even be looking at any type of imputed income? What it would seem to be, the question is, why are we not looking at his retirement income? Because that's where you find him at the time you file for the increase in spousal support.
Well, I think we should be. I think the court should have taken into account his post-retirement income.
Why?
Because that's a good indicator of what he's capable of making. And I don't argue, Your Honor, that to get to the first part of your remark, I don't argue that the court had to impute any given amount of income, but I do argue that it was abuse of discretion not even to consider this income stream of $45,000, which he had recently. Now, let me get on to the point of, well, what is recent past earnings? And I think that differs from job to job and setting to setting. And first of all, the courts have not established any bright line. There's no case that said, hey, this is too far back to be recent past earnings that I know of. I will say, in candor, I think the reported cases that do address the issue all happen to come up with time shorter, significantly shorter than 4 years. I think maybe a half a year to a year and a half or 2 years. But again, I think you have to look at this in the context of this gentleman's career. He spent 34 years working for the Navy, either as a naval officer or as a civilian. He was only out of that line of work for 4 years, which is 1 year in eight, if you do the arithmetic. So, and let's face it, the Navy is not going away. It's been around a long time. It's burgeoning, if anything, with the war on terror. Those jobs are there. So in the context of his job, I think for, I mean, I guess the court is aware that a Navy captain is one rank below a Navy admiral. This man has tremendous qualification, and he was an aviator. He has tremendous qualification. He's very marketable in the real world. He's very, very marketable.
He's also 62.
He's 62.
And how long would you have him have to work?
Well, Your Honor, I'm 72, so I would suggest. No, I don't know, Your Honor. I don't
I
think
the
that,
door
question
that question
is. I'm not prepared to answer that question. I would like to raise one point, which I think is kind of interesting, which honestly, it's not in my brief because it didn't occur to me until very recently, and that is to look at the BRICH, B-R-I-S-A-C-H case, which is cited in both briefs. That case clearly, unmistakably, did consider pre-retirement income as a basis for imputing income later on. Now, I'm thinking to myself, well, do all these other cases that say, well, you can't consider pre-retirement income in imputing or in imputing earning capacity, are they, did they overrule that case? Well, you shepherdize it. It hasn't been criticized at all. Now, here's the only thing I will say. The unique thing about that case and the case at bar is that in that case, is that we don't have a man or a person retiring at an ordinary retirement age. In both of those cases, we have an individual retiring at a very young age, Mr. BRICH at 52 and Mr. Captain Leeds at 49. So the court could, I mean, I don't know if the earlier case has been overruled by these inferentially, if you will, or not, but I think that's something the court should take a look at. And before I run out of time, if I may, I want to move on to this question about the wife's need. There is a tremendous amount of argument in opposing counsel's brief that goes to suggest that she spent $311,000 on litigation. That was foolish litigation, and it should not be credited in any event. That's fine and good, and that's a nice argument to make, but that's not the basis of the trial court's decision. The basis of the trial court's decision was not that the litigation was frivolous, and by the way, there wasn't any expert to say it was. The basis of the trial court's decision was that she had already paid off the $311,000 during the most of that, by the way, during the pendency of this case. So, but here's the thing. Yeah, she had paid off 90% of it, but that had reduced her financial resources. And under 20-107.1E, I believe it is, financial resources is a criteria in a, for lack of a better term, virgin spousal support case. A court is mandated to take into account, not mandated in a modification case, admittedly, but certainly well advised. And I think when you're talking about a quantum of money like $300,000, it would be an abuse of discretion not to look at that. Not to,
I just
not
want to know you're in your rebuttal. You're welcome to keep.
Well, thank you very much,
sure,
Your Honor.
Sure.
So, you know, and as to the point that the litigation was frivolous, because everybody, most of, we all know that legal and medical malpractice cases are normally taken on a contingency, and this client was paying by the hour for this, obviously. But the litigation, you can't, the only evidence, if you will, there was no, the only evidence that the litigation was unreasonable was that it was unsuccessful. But when you think about it, 50% of all cases in all courts are unsuccessful. So that's not a basis for concluding that the litigation was unreasonable. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Sure.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Cassandra Chin. I'm a counsel for the appellee Robert George Leeds. As a preliminary matter, I do want to reassert the motion to dismiss appeal that we filed based on Rule 5A20 with regard to opening briefs because Ms. Collins failed to state assignments of error with clear and exact references to page number where error were preserved in the trial court. In the
you
opening,
you are aware, though, that you know even if the court were to agree with you, it would, the case law says we don't dismiss; we would simply affirm.
Correct, Your Honor. So I would like to reassert, though, the grounds in my motion to dismiss in order to ask the court to consider that in considering the brief. The brief in opposition was filed 17 days after the opening brief was due, which was already after a 10-day extension was granted by this court. And I do not believe there's anything in the Supreme Court rules that would allow Ms. Collins to cure this failure by filing a brief in opposition to a motion to dismiss. With regard to the substantive matters in this case, Judge Gardner stated in his order that he didn't impute income to Mr. Leeds because there was no evidence of the husband's post-retirement earning capacity on which to base an imputed income. Our assertion to the court is that the retirement that he's referencing in this order is not necessarily the retirement from the military, which happened at the age of 58, but at 52, but rather the retirement from his second line of work as a civilian, which happened 4 years prior to this court hearing. Some guiding principles. Subalpine, the circumstances in existing at the time of the award, the relevant time period being the immediate past and the immediate or reasonably foreseeable future. And the burden here was on Ms. Collins to present evidence to the court sufficient enough to enable that trial court to impute income to him. And in the DeCamp case, this court stated that a trial court's refusal to impute income is not going to be in reverse unless it's plainly wrong or unsupported by the evidence. This is not a Stubblebine type case. In Stubblebine, Mr. Stubblebine had been employed as a consultant about 5 months before the filing of the divorce proceedings. It was also an initial proceeding for divorce. So this happened on the eve of that occurring. Mr. Stubblebine, as everybody knows, was working 50 to 60 hour per week doing volunteer work for a para psychology organization and then another 20 weeks helping a female friend with her psychiatry practice. That's simply not the evidence that was presented to this court. There was no evidence of recent past earnings. Mr. Leeds does do some volunteer work, but nothing close to what Mr. Stubblebine was doing. This case is also distinguishable from the Bresuch case that was just referenced. In that particular case, which is an unreported decision, Mr. Bresuch was 52 years old, and although it doesn't address in the opinion itself what specific evidence was addressed, it does state very explicitly in the ruling that specific evidence was considered by the trial court. That's not the situation here.
Can I ask you on that? In Bresuch, he was 52, and here, my understanding was, is your client was when he retired from the Navy, upon which his actual pension for life is based, he was 49, is that right?
I believe he was 48 or 49. It was in 2004.
And so, just in the if that's the retirement upon which then spousal support would be based or factored in, if he retired at 49 or 48, does that reduce his pension significantly such that perhaps the argument could be made that some more income should be imputed?
Well,
Your Honor, he was able to work for years after that at a six-figure salary.
Your Honor, at the point of his retirement, you have to recall that the parties were still married. So this was a decision that was made during the course of their marriage. By the time they got to their final divorce hearing and the property settlement agreement, that was already a done deal. This is not something that happened post-divorce. And frankly, I'll call it the second retirement, because I do, in fact, think that he retired two times. At the time of that retirement, you know, bear in mind that there was no spousal support award that he had to pay. There was this lingering reservation.
At that point, the $3,000 a month had stopped.
That had long been gone. I think that the $3,000 a month ended in 2011, early 2011. And so he didn't thereafter then retire for another almost 3 years. At that point in time, their daughter was 30 years old. She was finished with college. He had received significant inheritance from his parents that, you know, so he was able to plan for his retirement, his second retirement. So I would say to the court that although, you know, there was evidence of what Mr. Ben refers to as post-retirement income, it's post his first retirement. It's not post his second retirement, which was 4 years prior to this court hearing. I think the thing to realize, too, is that this case is much more in line with the DeCamp, the Harbor, the Donnell cases, and really the resounding theme of those is no evidence, no imputation. In DeCamp, I think that's a really interesting case because In that particular case involving a former nurse, there was actually an expert who came in and said, there are these jobs available, and these are what these jobs could earn. And everybody knows the nursing industry is booming. People can get jobs as a nurse. But the court in that case said that there wasn't enough evidence to provide potential income for the court to impute because the expert didn't know if those jobs were still available. And those jobs he was testifying about were available as of maybe a month or so before the hearing. I think it got continued, and that's why there was that question. And it's interesting to note also that the trial court in that case said it wasn't that Ms. DeCamp shouldn't work or couldn't work. It was that the husband failed to provide sufficient evidence. Likewise, in Harbor, again, talking about what recent past earnings is, that was a situation where there was a computer specialist who retired and moved to Florida. And the trial court was actually reversed by the Court of Appeals because it imputed income to husband at the pre-retirement income level when the wife didn't offer any evidence of current job availability, and that was 1.5 years after his retirement. 1.5 years. Donnell, this one was a retired CIA employee who was incarcerated. The court, again, reversed an imputation of income to the husband at a pre-retirement income level, stating that he had retired in good faith and not to avoid support, despite the fact that he was incarcerated and that's why he had to retire. And the court explicitly stated that the statutory scheme anticipates that awards are made in light of contemporary circumstances. So I believe that whether Mr. Leeds retired in 2004 or retired in May of 2013 isn't terribly relevant. The issue for the court was, was there current earning potential and job availability? And there was no evidence of that presented whatsoever. Frankly, I think it would have been reversible error if the trial court had simply plucked an income out of thin air and said, based on employment over 4 years ago with the Navy, I'm going to say that Mr. Leeds is capable of earning $145,000 a year. Sure, the Navy still exists. I think we can all acknowledge that. But there was no evidence that there is a similar position available, that there are contracts available. Government contracts, of course, are not constant. They're constantly evolving, changing, ending. And there's no evidence presented that Mr. Leeds would qualify for a position with a security clearance or current training. There wasn't evidence provided either way, whether he could or couldn't get a security clearance. The evidence before the court is he had one when he was with the Navy, and he no longer has one. That was the evidence that was presented to the court. Lastly, there was no evidence presented what Mr. Leeds could earn if there was a position available and if he was qualified. That's asking the trial court to make a lot of assumptions without any evidence. As we've already stated, at the time of the trial, Mr. Leeds was 62. He had been retired for over 4 years. He didn't have any obligation to pay support to his ex-wife or to his daughter at that point in time. And there just simply was no evidence that given the circumstances in existence at the time of the award in late 2017 that there was a job available for Mr. Leeds, that he was qualified for that job, and what he would earn if he had it. I would state to the court that the trial court carefully considered all of the evidence that was presented. This was, again, more than a one-day trial, and did not abuse its discretion, because that's what we're looking at here. Did the court abuse its discretion when it did not impute income to Mr. Leeds? None of the arguments raised by Ms. Collins demonstrate an abuse of discretion by the court, and accordingly, we would ask that the spousal support award be upheld by this court. With regard to the $311,000 in legal expenses, I would like to point the court's attention to paragraph 10 of the party's separation and property settlement agreement, which states that the wife shall have the right reserved to her to petition the appropriate court for an award of additional spousal support upon, one, a showing of substantial change in circumstances, or either of them, and the second part of that is justifying the award of spousal support. And as stated by appellant's counsel, in modification proceedings, the court is not required to consider all of the factors of 20-107.1. The court is governed by the party's agreement, which was incorporated into the terms of the final order.
I'm sorry, where were you reading from in the party's agreement?
I'm sorry, that was in the Appendix 680. That's the clause from the property settlement agreement that sets forth what their agreement is with regard to future spousal support. I was able to find several cases where this court upheld a trial court's exclusion or reduction of expenses in considering spousal support. In the DeCamp case, the trial court was free to consider and weigh the evidence of estimated needs and award spousal support within its discretion. In that particular case, the trial court excluded what they called non-spousal and exaggerated expenses, such as groceries and dining out. That decision was upheld by this court. Joins v. Payne. Similarly, the court upheld the commissioner's decision to reduce several of Ms. Payne's alleged expenses. That case doesn't go into any detail really about what those expenses were or why they did it, but simply said, court did it, fine. Howell versus Howell, which was the case cited by Judge Gardner in his order, the trial court excluded from spousal support award the wife's post-separation expenses, including non-recurring expenses for legal fees, car rental. And like in Howell, Judge Gardner excluded Ms. Collins' legal fees from the spousal support award. And he also excluded and reduced expenses for things like cable television, gifts, and church and charity. Ms. Collins' claim is that Judge Gardner erred because he stated in his ruling that she had already paid her legal expenses. But that's not exactly the only basis for which he made his ruling. If you read the judge's order, and this is going from the bottom of page 2. Further, the wife's legal and forensic expenses, in parentheses, $6,000 a month, are not monthly expenses, as the wife testified that those expenses were for her two medical malpractice and proceedings in the instant case, and that she has already paid those expenses. And I think that there's two separate things to look at there. With regard to the rationale here, you have to take into account that there are a lot of cases going on. There was a medical malpractice. There was a legal malpractice. There was what we call the assets case. And then there was the underlying spousal support case. Well, we all know, of course, that her medical malpractice and legal malpractice cases were not anything that Mr. Leeds was a party to, had no control over, and would not have, under any circumstances, been ordered to pay her fees for that. With regard to the assets case, that was a case that was ultimately dismissed with prejudice by the trial court. So again, something that Mr. Leeds would not have been responsible for as far as her attorney's fees. And then with regard to the spousal support, the parties stipulated to the court that the property settlement agreement did not give either party the ability to request fees in the spousal support modification case. So asking that to be included as part of her expenses is a backdoor way of asking the court to have Mr. Leeds pay attorney's fees that she couldn't have otherwise asked for. So I think that the court has to consider that, too. It wasn't just a very simplistic, well, she's paid it, so I'm just not going to consider it. I don't think that that's what the court's rationale was. In addition to that, I think it's something that the court took into consideration that in describing how she came up with the $6,000 a month, she said that she arrived at that number by taking the total amount of legal fees she paid over the years, plus whatever she'd incurred since then, and divided it somehow. That's what she said. And so that was the evidence she presented to court to support the idea that she should have $6,000 a month in legal fees be part of the consideration. By seeking spousal support for her excessive legal expenses, Ms. Collins was trying to hold Mr. Leeds financially responsible for her choice to litigate certain matters. Ms. Collins admitted that her litigation was unsuccessful. What if instead of spending $300,000 on litigation, she had invested it in stock that plummeted, or she had gambled it away in Vegas? The bottom line is this was a choice that she made, and the concept of the court not accepting it is not saying that it's unreasonable or making any determination to that fact, just simply saying, I'm not going to consider it because these are for other cases, legal malpractice, medical malpractice, and other cases to which Mr. Leeds is not responsible for fees. Since the appellant raises no arguments to demonstrate an abuse of discretion, we would ask that the trial court be affirmed, and we also ask that it be remanded to the circuit court for an award of attorney's fees and costs incurred during this appeal.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank
Chen.
You.
Mr. Denton, you've got just a little bit over a minute.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Very quickly, sure. Then. First point, the DeCamp case really has very little in common with this one. In that case, the husband was seeking to impute income to a wife or a former wife, a nurse. She had not worked for 21 years. So, and it wasn't a retirement. It wasn't an issue of retirement, imputing retirement income. The Donald case, the CIA case, and it's interesting how all these cases seem to involve government employees. But anyway, the Donald case, that was decided not on the basis of earlier income. The court decided that case on the basis of not being able to speculate as to what his future income would be. And that's really not an issue here. And lastly, you know, there is evidence of this husband's legitimate post-retirement income. Yes, it was 4 years back. The court could find that's too far. The court could also find that it, within the context of this kind of a career, that it's not too far. And so the relief we requested is that it be reversed, remanded, with instructions to the trial court to consider the civilian income after his Navy career as post-retirement income, and to evaluate the $311,000 expenses and litigation costs.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
We'll come down and greet counsel.
All right.